Oh, hands in the circle. Go team. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the BAMP podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And as most of you are probably aware, I also wear the hat as, what would you call me, Fango Publishing? Or Fango Games? I guess I'm the,
Godfather.
The Godfather. I'm the father of Grandfather.
Grandfather. Grandfather Goat.
I am the guy who runs Fango Games. Bah. And,
maybe we should call you the Goatfather.
Yeah, it's even better.
That would look nice on a t-shirt, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And so we did Stark City, which I'm guessing a fair number of our listeners are into Icons and probably know about the Kickstarter. And we kind of doing this podcast as sort of a director's commentary like you see on DVDs, or sometimes just an interview with the RPG writer saying, here's my influences and here's what I was thinking in this book. We did an add-on for Stark City called The Great Game, Cosmic Roleplaying in the Stark City Universe. And this my impulse to do this came from two things. Number one, there are some delays in Stark City, and I want to say thank you to the backers for not getting incredibly pissed at me. And I always wanted to, there was some hints of cosmic stuff in the book that weren't really fleshed out. I thought it would make a really nice supplement. And Steve Perrin and his buddy Mike Bloom had contributed some material in the early days of Stark City for some background, and Jason Chandro came in and did really most of the heavy lifting, fleshing it out. Myself, Joe Bardalis, and I think Adrian, you might contribute a little bit to this book, didn't you? Or am I?
Yeah, probably a few ideas here and there. Yeah.
Okay.
You did all of our graphic layout.
Well, I did that. Yeah.
You're the guy that makes it all work.
Yeah, we had got some nice layout. The covers by. I don't want to do the whole credits up front because that'll be long and tedious and boring. But got a great cover by John Gibbons. But yeah, Jason, I'll tell you what, why don't we open up the floor, and if the listeners, if you're into cosmic comics and cosmic RPGs, keep on listening. That's not your ball of wax. Maybe you want to check us out next week. But we're going to open up the floor to Jason to kind of talk about the book The Great Game, which is Cosmic Roleplaying in the Stark City Universe, and kind of tell us about, your influences and what motive, and, Jason, let me hand the mic to you, and I'll stop talking now.
Yeah, well, so the secret origin of this book is a while ago I called up you, I called up Mike, and I said, I want to write something for you, and I don't care what it is. And I just had so much fun writing on Stark City, and I just love working with you and with your company. And I said, I just want to write something for you, I don't care what. And you said, well, I've got this space outline we haven't finished. Do you want to write a space book? And I was like, yes, give me that. Because I was very worried that I had done a lot of kind of classic Silver Age stuff for Icons, and I was worried that I was being sort of typecast as the Silver Age guy. And so I wanted to sort of stretch my legs a little bit and do something very different. And space is great for that, because as so many writers over the years have done, they take a character and they send them to space, and crazy shit happens for a year and a half, We saw this with Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. We've seen it with when the X-Men went off to space and met the Star Jammers and all that stuff. What's that?
They just sent Iron Man to team up with the Guardians of the Galaxy for a 4-5 issues.
Yeah, but see, that's all movie-oriented. That's like, you've got to tie it into the films. I'm talking about, when a book is kind of stale and the writer wants to do something really different with it, and so they go off into space, and because space is so big, they can invent whatever they want. They can just invent new planets and new bad guys and new. They don't have to worry about continuity. And because they don't have to worry about continuity, their imagination can get very, very excited. And so I was really looking forward to doing that. So I said, yes, give me this space book. Then then I got the outline. And the outline and a lot of the basic material was done by Steve, who it's always an incredible honor to work with. Steve's a legend in gaming, and I still remember playing RuneQuest when I was in junior high, So, and Steve has worked in every genre you can imagine. He's done animated television cartoons. He's done everything you can imagine. And so when Steve sat down to write a space book, he did sci-fi. He did pretty hardcore sci-fi. Now, there is some mystical and magical elements in the book, kind of dark sorcery. We had like a dire race kind of race in there. But it was fairly straightforward science fiction and kind of space opera. you know, you have huge fleets of spaceships and invading armies with armies of robots and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it occurred to me that there were two things that I felt like I could really bring to this project. The first is when superheroes have adventures with space enemies or when they go to space, there are those scenes where they fight a fleet of spaceships, but those are not the climactic moments of the story. The climactic moment is not fighting a bunch of spaceships. It's when you beat down on the Super Skrull or whatever. It's in superhero comics, it's about that duel between the hero and the alien champion. And that is the ultimate moment in a superhero space game, not the hardware, which is weird because in sci-fi we think, you know, it's all about spaceships and laser guns. But in a superhero space game, it's not really. So I wanted to bring a lot more of the personalities. I wanted to create some enemy villains, essentially. I hate to use that word villains because, of course, none of them think they're villains. But I want to create some enemy antagonists that were aliens, which could engage in dramatic beatdowns with player characters. And that's really one of the things I wanted to bring. And the second thing that I knew that we had to have in this book was we had no Kirby space gods. And I'm sorry, I just cannot do in good conscience a book about adventuring in space without acknowledging, you know, the Kirby crackle. So I had to figure out what I was going to do with that. Now, Steve had this idea that in the center of the galaxy, in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, was this terribly ancient and mysterious race that lived in what he called the core, which is where the stars are close together in the middle of the galaxy. And he had them like 60,000 years old or something. I forget exactly how old their civilization was.
I think it was more like billion, but yeah.
Yeah. And they were kind of loosely inspired by the Borlons, if you remember, if all of our old Babylon 5 fans. They were very powerful, but they were very mysterious and very remote. Nobody ever goes there. And I saw this as an opportunity where we could take out the sci-fi, the sort of traditional space opera, Borlon stuff, and replace it with the race of Kirby space gods, which I named the Prometheans. And the idea behind the race and the story that they filled in the overall plot stayed the same, which is that this is where superhuman powers come from on Earth. That 60,000 years ago, this core race, the Prometheans, came to Earth looking for a slave race that they could mutate with superhuman powers. And they found human beings, and they made them into this race of superpowered slaves, and they took all of the superhuman beings, almost all of them, off of the planet to become their soldiers in this galactic crusade. But they left behind, like, all the rejects, like all the mutants who maybe they were a little dysfunctional, maybe their powers weren't quite as good as they needed to be, or maybe the slaves themselves were a little bit too rebellious and wouldn't obey orders or whatever. And so they left kind of the rejects on Earth. And it is from these that all superhuman powers on Earth descend. Steve figured that out. Steve came up with a concept for sort of where superhuman powers come from in the Stark City universe. And I kept all of that. I just swapped out the Borlons for, you know, the new gods, kind of inspired rather than traditional sci-fi.
Now the going with the Prometheans, that kind of provides the framework and that's the reason for the title of the book. Maybe
so. Yeah. Okay. So the title of the book, The Great Game, and I'm sort of surprised you guys went with that title because I thought for sure you would change it.
I could think of a better one.
Yeah. But you're right, because it's totally baked into the entire book. And it's all inspired by, that idea was inspired by this one issue of Alan Moore's Top Ten. Those of you that ever read Alan Moore's Top Ten when he was originally writing the book, it's since been continued on by different writers and artists at DC. But there's one issue where... if you remember that the idea behind Top Ten, it's that there's a they live in a city where everybody in the entire city has superpowers, and there's a police precinct in that city, the 10th precinct. So you have these superpowered policemen in a city where everyone from the schoolyard custodian to the mayor, everybody has superpowers. And in one of these issues, there is a traffic accident. There's a traffic accident. Well, that sounds like the most boring, mundane kind of day for a cop, except that this is a superhero city, and so the traffic accident is between this kind of Commander Arcturus Rand. What was his name? The space traveler guy in DC with the jetpack and the pistol.
Adam Strange.
This sort of Adam Strange guy and his wife riding a Buck Rogers rocket ship has collided while teleporting with a giant sort of Jack Kirby horse-headed space god warrior. And their bodies have merged, like the old Fly movie. Their bodies have merged, and they're both dying, and there's no way that they can be separated because the rocket ship has, like, integrated itself into the Kirby guy's body. And the woman is already dead, and the Adam Strange guy is, like, the lower half of his body is fused into this guy. So they're all going to die, and there's nothing that the cop can do except stand around and try to keep them company while they slowly die. And it sounds like the most depressing story you could imagine. But because Alan Moore is Alan Moore, it's astonishingly positive. He makes this story into an amazing read. And it all comes together at the end. I don't want to spoil anything, but I quote it a little bit, and I can't do it justice anyway in a one-hour conversation. You also just read it. But in their conversation, this Kirby space god guy has a moment where he looks up at the sky, and he can see the stars in the night sky, and he says, "This is the great board of lights," is what he says. "And there is the great black, and there is the great white." And the sort of Buck Rogers guy says, but white is so small. I mean, surely we must be losing." And the big alien guy says, no, we're winning. I forget how he explains it.
These lips look above you, do you see? That is called the immense board of lights. And there is the great black. And strewn across it, small and surrounded and vulnerable and brave, there is the great white.
Yeah. And I took that image, that idea of the night sky and the stars as a kind of chessboard. And that's where the idea came from. So that I renamed it, because being a college professor, I'm very sensitive to issues of race. And I didn't want to deal with blackness and whiteness, because I thought that was just too loaded. I didn't want to play into the idea that, you know, black is bad and white is good. I would not have been able to sleep at night if I wrote that book. So instead, I recast it as darkness and bright, which is a little bit which is different enough that my conscience was clear. And all of the organizations that are in this book, all of the races and empires and far-flung civilizations, are all kind of allied with either the greater dark, which are embodied as forces of entropy and death and lifelessness. And on the other side is the great bright, which is not only life and a celebration of life, which is what this particular Alan Moore story is ultimately about, the celebration of life, but also a kind of a celebration of order and civilization and intellect and all of that. And so you have these two forces kind of going at it, and Steve's outline had some of this in it, because he had created a bad guy society called the Eidolon, which we kept, and they're in the book. And the Eidolon was this god, this sort of Cthulhu-like space deity, which wanted to come to our galaxy and destroy it.
Well, I think the Eidolon were actually me.
Well, was that you?
I think so.
Oh, well then, you know, credit where credit is due, sir. Well, and And the force that, and this god that they worshipped was kind of an incarnation of entropy. Well, I'd actually already played with entropy in the state in the Stark City book, because it was in one casual byline of Stark City where I was writing up the history of the city when I mentioned Entropos, the embodiment of entropy in the galaxy, who was my obvious sort of Galactus homage. And except Entropos, rather than coming to a planet and consuming it, because that's sort of obvious, like that's sort of definitive. If you eat a planet, it's gone. You can't ever go back there. Which is great, except that when you're in a game, a serial game that has to go on every week or every month for years, it's kind of bad to lose a set like that. So instead, Entropos doesn't destroy a planet. He deprives it of all of its meaning. I know it sounds very highbrow, but ultimately what this that just means is that he makes it basically boring and dull. Like, he takes away everything that's cool about it. All of the stuff that's exciting and interesting, and takes that away and makes it sort of boring and repetitive and uninteresting. He turns it into the internet, basically. And so I swapped out some stuff. So like the Eidolon's god, I changed into kind of more of a Thanos adversary. Because we had that beautiful illustration by John Gibbons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of this mysterious guy with a, like, all in black with sort of a cosmic look to him. And this big, long, golden spear. I didn't know who this guy was, but clearly he was a badass. So I made him... the villain, who we ended up naming Crux Morta, the Cross of Death, and he's basically our Thanos. He's like the ultimate space villain who is still punchable, as opposed to Entropos, who is basically non-punchable because he's a god or godlike. He's a, what do they call them in Marvel?
Force of nature.
they have these names like the elders of the universe.
Of the universe, that's right, yeah.
He's one of those. And so once I sort of had these things filled in, then we got a bunch of the other art. And Mike, you gave me a bunch of art that had already been done for the book.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, it's very little secrets. I've been wanting to do a cosmic book for years. And,
So have you been storing all this art up?
That piece by John, the first piece of Crux Morta, I bought from him like 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
With the intent of at some point doing a cosmic book.
Well, Crux ended up getting another appearance on the cover, which was great. And you gave me a bunch of art. We had like the Dire Wraith Eidolon dudes, which I love because I was a huge fan of ROM as a high schooler. Like, I read all those ROM books. It surprises nobody who knows. So we had Eidolons and we had a ROM homage with art. It was a little bit too spot on for ROM, but what the hell, it was a good piece, so we used it. And we named him Trontris, which is my Trontis, which is my homage to Tristan, the knight from Arthurian legend.
I missed that. That's cool.
Well, yeah. Tristan had a secret identity. Tristan changed his name to Tantris, and This being a comic book, nobody recognized him. So it's the same way with our guy. So I renamed him Tantris and Trontis. And I also worked in, and this is very much hard to see, but I also worked in my Nexus homage.
Oh, really?
Did you guys read Nexus?
Dude, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, like 20 years ago, exactly. Well, I just really admired Nexus because it was so crazy. And it was so unlike every other book coming out at the time. And if you remember in Nexus, there was this deal with the fusion casting heads. Do you remember the heads?
You better refresh my memory.
Okay, all right. So you have to take a step back. Remember Nexus? Nexus had what he called fusion casting powers. You know, he could shoot big energy blasts, basically. Well, his fusion casting power came from this alien entity. But there were other ways to get fusion casting powers. And one of those ways was, and this sounds bizarre, so just work with me. If you get a bunch of people and you do a surgical operation that decapitates them, you separate their head from their body, This gives that head psychic powers, which it can then give to someone else, and it grants that person fusion casting power. So you had these villains who would fight Nexus, and they were fueled by 1,000 heads. Okay. The idea was they had, like, literally had a room full of these disembodied heads whose psychic power energized them. It was the craziest shit you'd ever read.
Now, just for anyone who hasn't heard of it, Nexus was published between 81 to 91. Capital Comics, Bush Comics, Dark Horse Comics, created by Mike Baron.
Matt Baron and Steve Rude.
Steve Rude, yeah.
Steve Rude, yeah. Great artwork. Marvelous artwork.
Yeah, the artwork was amazing. And also, you should know this because Nexus was very much inspired by Space Ghost.
Yeah, they apparently Jen and some of Jen and Bleep and Jace had uncredited cameos, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. So and I know that you're a big old Space Ghost fan.
Yeah. Well, one of my goals for this book, I don't want to. Let me say I love role playing games and I love superhero playing games, but a lot of times there's certain tropes you'll always see, and one of those is there's always a Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah.
And there's certain other homages I always get paid. And there's some things that don't get serviced, like ROM or Space Ghost.
Yeah.
So one of my goal, or the Herculoids, one of my goal in doing a cosmic book was to do some of the nooks and crannies that don't always get a hat tip.
You know what I just, you know, I was thinking about this podcast. You know what I wish I'd had room to put in the book?
What's that?
Micronauts.
Oh, that was awesome.
Oh, I missed those Micronauts. All right. Yeah, and you came, you also asked me to work in the whole Chip Carrington plotline.
Yeah, let's why don't you go into that a little bit, because that's that plays directly into Stark.
It does. Those of you that remember from Stark City, there's this World War II, sort of 1930s era, adventurer sportsman named Chip Carrington. I think he was a baseball player.
Yeah, yeah.
And he becomes this sort of globe-trotting adventurer who gets given his airplane. And then he mysteriously vanishes. And there's a restaurant in the city named after his airplane, and he's a hero of the city. Well, so what happened to Chip Carrington is this huge mystery. Well, Mike had already done a Justice Wheels source
PDF,
thank you. A Justice Wheels PDF that had a stats for Chip Carrington and his new spaceship as he got flung across the galaxy and sort of dropped into this Flash Gordon-style Civil War going on with, I think, what'd you call him? Like, Bongo the Mighty, or what was the bad? I can't remember what his name was.
I think the Crobon Empire?
The Crobons, yeah, the Crobon
Empire. It was written by Joe Bardalis.
Oh, Joe wrote that?
I wrote that. The Crowbine Empire, yeah.
Joe is like the nicest guy in the world. I work with Joe all day long. Well, anyway.
And he has a fine singing voice, so I don't know if you knew that. But yeah.
I don't know that. You know what? He should. It suits him. Anyway, so yeah, he had written. So Joe had written this deal with the Crowbine Empire. And so now I got sort of like, okay, well, all we know about it is its name. That's literally all we know about it. And the name of the evil Krang the Conqueror.
Yeah. Krang Commanding, Krang the Cruel, and many other less principal sobriquets.
Yeah. But all that we got from him was originally just Krang the Conqueror. And so I had to, like, make up everything. And I thought, well, what are we going to do? Because Chip was captured and or was transported in, like, the late 1930s.
Yeah.
And it's been 80 years, you know? So is he still trying to fight the good fight 80 years on, or what? And I decided that, you know, I just don't think... I think Flash Gordon, who's a lot of his cool, he's been doing the same thing for 80 years. I mean, if he hasn't won yet. So I decided instead that he had been captured and also transported through time. So as far as Chip knows, it's still 1938, or whenever he was captured. So when the players show up... they're gonna end up telling him that, oh, and by the way, everybody you knew on Earth is dead. So that'll be kind of cool.
Yeah, the man of time element going on, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then let's see, what else did we do there? Oh, and then I had a lot of fun inventing all the different races and civilizations that are part of the Empire. So, you know, we have, what did we, I can't recall them. We all, the Tricero Tyrants, and the Vegetable Men, and the Tarantula Labs, and all kinds of crazy shit.
The Vegetable Man of Squamous 5.
Yeah. It was fun just to invent this stuff, and throw out these ideas and hint at what they were, because I knew I wouldn't have the room to fully develop them. So all we could really do was kind of suggest. And Krang became part of the Promethean plotline. He became an exiled Promethean, one of these Kirby space gods, who was essentially exiled and was now slumming as the master of this Ming the Merciless sort of Mongo Empire. And that allowed us to tie a lot of the plots together, which was cool.
Yeah, that's just, I was reading through it, I like this one particular phrase you had, talking about the races of the Kerbon Empire. The hauntingly beautiful black sirens of Kirupta, who navigate the depths of space with songs seductive and deadly.
Yeah, well, I wanted to have bat women, right? But I can't just call them bat women, because, you know.
You know, I've been thinking about, I like to do, like, short PDFs to serve as, you know, kind of an enticer, you know, sell them for a buck and say, hey, if you like this, check out the main book.
Yeah.
I was thinking about talking to Aid, see if we could do some layout that looks like the old action figure packaging.
Oh.
Maybe do some representatives that, you know, from some of these groups we just hint at.
Oh, yeah, that would be fun. And I got to use the Tricero Tyrants showed up again in the Blood Moon. The Blood Moon Protectorate.
The Bloodstone.
The Bloodstone. That's it. Bloodstone. Not Blood Moon. Blood Moon was the Monster Hunter from Marvel. right? Is that right?
Yeah.
No, that was Bloodstone. You just see Bloodstone.
He was Bloodstone, too.
Yeah.
Oh, well. So now I'm just screwed both ways.
Marvel's not going to sue us.
Mike had given me this. I don't know who came up with the Bloodstone Protectorate.
It was actually me. The idea, once again, it's one of those things that doesn't really ever get serviced much in RPG settings, and that's no one really does the evil Green Lantern Corps, and no one does, like, the Sinestro Corps.
Right.
Or,
so you said, well, here I got this idea, and I have this art, and this piece of art was, like, a dinosaur guy with power wings.
That was AIDS, yeah.
That's one of the
That was you?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, great, good. Well, I'm glad I got to use it. So I made him into the champion of the Bloodstone Protectorate, and he's one of these Tricero Tyrants, one of these dinosaur warriors. And the Bloodstone Protectorate is, they're basically Green Lantern powers, but they are a giant protection racket whose mastermind is kind of based on Ego the Living Planet. This was your idea, I think. At least that's what you told me about it.
Yeah, because when I was reading Nova Corps the last time around, there was, was like 5 or 6 years ago, there was a short period of time when Ego the Living Planet was the base of the Nova Corps.
Yeah.
And then there was some drama there as it reasserted itself and it was fighting with the World Knight. I thought, that'd be kind of cool, just, you know, as a pure villain, just a some shame story.
Yeah. Well, my memories of Ego are all from the Hulk, you know, where I think he first appeared. I might be wrong. And so I had a lot of fun finding a way to make this sort of all fit in the overriding plot line. And what else have we missed?
The Ghostlight.
I'm sorry?
The Syrian Principality and the Ghostlight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Okay, so the Syrians. And boy, you caught me on this one. You and Steve rescued me from a huge mistake. thank God. So I sat down to make the Syrians, and I knew that they were going to be agents of the... They were going to be good guys. They were going to be agents of the Greater Bright. And they were responsible for a kind of blockade around Earth that had kept aliens from really making contact with human beings. And the other way around, and it kept human beings from getting off planet. This is important, because one of the interesting things, and I think Steve came up with this, but I might be wrong, maybe this is you. One of the interesting things about this setting is that when human beings leave Earth and start encountering aliens, aliens know who humans are. aliens, human beings are not like this weird backwater race from nowhere, which is how they're commonly portrayed in sci-fi. Instead, human beings are feared as this terrible scourge of the universe who burnt through the galaxy 60,000 years ago, killing everything in their path.
As the slave army of the Prometheans.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, people tell, like, little aliens tell their children, you know, don't stay out too late at night or some human will eat you, you know. And so when human heroes leave Earth, they'll have this huge social barrier to sort of overcome, which gives them a nice goal, sort of prove that, hey, you know, humans aren't all bad and that kind of thing.
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
I'd step away for 1 second because Young Master Connor, my son, is having a little incident.
Oh, of course.
But Jason, just keep on rhapsodizing. I'll be back momentarily.
All right, you bet. All right. Have I run completely over you enough? You, something you want to...
No, it's cool. Carry on.
All right. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. So the Syrians kept everybody sort of locked in on Earth. And this actually saved humanity from extinction because of the crusade against humanity that had been conducted in the wake of the Promethean Wars. All right. So the Syrians are good guys. But as I mentioned before, I was really conscious of issues of race. So I really wanted to make sure that the Syrians did not fall into that classic archetype of everybody good is beautiful looking and everybody evil is ugly. Right, the sort of X-Men movie problem, right? I'm talking about the first X-Men movie where all Magneto's henchmen were all ugly and all of the X-Men were all beautiful supermodels.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Toad and Blob. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I decided Syrians were going to be black. And not just, like, kind of black, but, like, supernaturally black. I described them as, like, living solar panels. Their bodies are black, so that they can better absorb solar radiation, and they live on this solar radiation. So their bodies are completely black and hairless. They're beautiful, but in a very non-traditional kind of way. I should say unexpected kind of way. What a problem with this. First, the first thing happens that when Dan... the Syrians are also where our Space Ghost homage is located. I think they are the Ghost Light. The Ghost Light Legion. And so when I went to make a member of the Ghost Light to be kind of an NPC that the player characters would interact with, I totally ripped off Jaina. Wasn't it Jaina the name of Space Ghost?
Yeah, Jaina,
like,
that's right. Yep.
Yeah, Jaina. So I basically made grown-up Jaina, and she's all kind of bitter and jaded, and her brother has been missing, presumed dead for years, and she had her last love affair was with a living comet, which is... a reference to an actual Space Ghost comic where Jaina, like, flirted with some comet kid. Anyway.
I'm back.
Welcome back.
Hey.
And so we got art back for Jaina, and, of course, she was white and blonde. And she had, you know, long, flowing blonde hair and looked as cute and perky as Jaina ever looked on Space Ghost. I'm like, she doesn't look like that. She's got to be black and hairless. And Dan was like, what? And I can't blame him for being surprised, because, you know, if you're going to homage something, it's usually the visuals that get homaged. Well, anyway. So we fix that, but then Mike writes to me and says, hey, wasn't the Sentinel Syrian?
And just, the Sentinel is kind of the... one of the background historical characters in Stark City.
Yeah, he's like Superman. He's like the first superhero.
Yeah, and he was a white guy.
He was clearly white, and he was identical to human. He looked human.
Yeah, we had a bunch of art of him in the book, and of his descendants.
Exactly.
And so, yeah.
And I still didn't get what Mike was talking about. I think I wrote back and said, yeah, I think he was. Why? Right? and then Steve gets involved, and Steve writes and says, well, you have a problem here, because the Sentinel is white, and you describe the Syrians looking like living solar panels. So what are you going to do? Oh, and I also described the Sentinel as fleeing from a repressive Syrian monarchy. So now I'm in trouble both ways. Not only have I physically messed up their appearance, but I've also characterized them differently in the new book than we characterized them in Dark City. You know, but Marvel retcon to the rescue, right?
Folks, this is how the sausage gets made. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out this is exactly the same problem that Marvel Comics had when Captain Marvel showed up. Because the Kree are blue. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Kree are blue, and yet Captain Marvel is a blonde white dude. Right? So I literally just used the Captain Marvel solution. Oh, there's a recessive strain of Syrians that intermingled with humanity thousands of years ago and now look like them. And it's like a recessive sort of mutant gene that pops up every once in a while, just like Mar-Vell. And that's what the Sentinel was. He was one of these human evolutionary throwbacks. And Mike solved the political problem by creating a sort of rebel faction inside the Syrian government that wants to conquer the Earth and use humanity as another generation of superpowered space warrior slaves. And it was those guys that the Sentinel was fleeing back in the... When did he come? Like in the 1850s or something?
Yeah, the original Sentinel was kind of a frontiersman.
Yeah.
So, it was the House of Fandor.
Yeah. So we solved it that way, but it was my egg on the face moment. Or just
this might be too much sausage making talk, but I was rereading Marvel's Annihilation. In the Kree Empire, they have some of that politics going on. One of the commerce houses, I forget the name of it now, takes control of the Empire and kills the Supreme Intelligence and causes all kinds of problems.
That's right.
And so I kind of based House Fandor on them. And that was how we solved that problem. But, let us have the Terran Principality, which is, if you're playing in this setting, it's probably going to be one of the first places you wind up going.
Yeah, I wanted to create a kind of welcoming place, a good guy empire that was besieged by bad guys. So the Bloodstone Protectorate is at war with them. And it created a place where the protagonists, the heroes of the game, the player characters, could find some potential allies. And I tried to build a plot in there. I sort of modeled the prince of the Syrians on the lead character in The American President.
I did not catch that.
Yeah, he's like a shepherd. What was his name? Matthew Shepherd?
The American President. You're going to make me Google it. Is that the one with Michael Douglas?
Yeah, Michael Douglas, yeah. So just like President Shepard in that film, the prince is a widow. He's a widower. Who's got like a 13-year-old daughter, and he's really nervous about raising her. And he's a really good guy, but he's kind of surrounded by political enemies. And so I wanted to build a potential like romantic subplot, because all of these alien adventures always have a romantic subplot. So that
if you can't go into space and fall in love with green women, what's the point of going?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, but girl lifts to God's ears, right? So I put in this alien, really admirable kind of guy who was good and strong and charismatic, but had a lot of enemies that the players could help him out with. And
it is President Andrew Shepard.
Andrew Shepard, yeah. Andrew Shepard.
Good, thank you. And that Benning was Sidney Ellen Wade.
Yes. That's right.
Have we talked about the Ghost Light yet?
We mentioned it briefly. We didn't really go into it. We mentioned that they were our sort of space ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to a tip of the hat to Space Ghost. And you got to have some kind of space cop organization with that your PCs can interact or conflict with or join up with.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be cool if we had, space cops who were space ghosts?
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to make sure to do in this book is create a lot of potential player character origin stories. In other words, if you say, well, I want to be like an alien, or I want to have like an alien super weapon. Well, you don't have to invent that alien super weapon anymore. You could just use a ghost light. Oh, I'm the wielder of a ghost light, or I have a piece of the blood moon, or I'm a Promethean from the core worlds, or whatever. And this gives you a really identifiable power set, and you also fit into the setting already, so you can encounter others who also have your powers. And you could start getting orders from the Ghostlight Commander, or you could be recalled back to the... You could start to feel the evil, corrupting presence of the Blood Moon, the Bloodstone, talking to you, or whatever. I wanted to create a lot of player character origin stories in this book, so if you wanted to do a sort of Legion of Superheroes kind of game, where every player character is a different alien embodiment, and then you have the token Earthling as the lead, you know. You could do that with this book. There's a whole long essay in this book on running, how to run a space game, a cosmic game, and what that means and what some of the common tropes are. Like, well, are you going to make the players go out to space, or are you going to make the space come to the players? And what kind of adversaries do they fight, and what kind of stories and plots are they about, and what kind of themes and issues are they about? So, for example, when you talk about an alien invasion, well, you're going to need an alien invader to do that with. Okay, well, here, let's give you one. Let's give you the Eidolons and all of their, and Crux Morta and all of his allies. He's got a whole army of alien mercenaries taken straight out of Thanos' comics, and he's got a bunch of super-powered, misanthropic henchmen, what I call the Hate Chamber, which are straight out of the New Gods. And you just use them. Okay, well, so what are alien invasion stories about? Well, in superhero comics, alien invasion stories are normally about confusion and understanding. In other words, when the aliens show up, the heroes don't understand them, and they have to fight. But at some point, the heroes figure out the mystery or the secret or whatever it is that they need to know to defeat the alien threat. And it's about understanding. Once you've figured out the enemy, victory is fairly easy. You just have to, the challenge comes in the figuring out part. Once you realize, oh, I can make the ultimate nullifier, the lights will go away, right? And this is in contrast to the stories where you leave Earth and you go out into outer space, where you've got a lot of other alien civilizations, and instead, what you end up with is a lot of questioning of the Earth. So, for example, you meet an alien, and the alien says, well, that's really weird the way you guys do that. Why do you do that crazy thing? And it makes us ask questions about our own activities and our own morals and our values, and even just our ordinary everyday practices. And examples of this come from things like in the Titans, when Starfire would walk around naked, and at first it was just kind of a gag. But it was just her asking, well, that's silly. Why do you wear clothes all the time? That's so stupid. But then it became more interesting and more complicated, and it became like, well, why don't you just kill a villain if he's going to do something bad? And you know he's going to do something bad. Why don't you just kill him? Because I would. And it's a time for us to investigate ourselves and our own beliefs. So in that case, aliens act like mirrors and as a kind of neutral interrogator.
Oh, cool, cool. Yeah, there's a long and well-written essay about how to run a cosmic game. Jason mentioned we have a bunch of different factions. I want to tie it back into kind of our design philosophy on Stark City. Stark City is a city that needs heroes. We didn't do as good a job as I wanted to in development in keeping NPC heroes out of the book. And part of that's because people like writing heroes, and part of that's because we had Kickstarter backers who want to contribute NPCs, and
that's right.
To contribute a backer. But we tried to minimize as much as possible just so there wouldn't be people to overshadow the PCs, and it gives you something to do. I mean, the world's on the brink. There's a call to action. And that same philosophy goes forth with a great game. You know, it's there in the title. The idea is, you know, there's a fight that needs fighting. There's things that need to be protected.
Yeah, whenever we created a heroic personality for this book, I always wanted to be somebody the players were going to have to either fight or interact with in a long sense. So, for example, let's take our Rom dude. Now, Rom's a hero. You know, he's a good guy. But if you remember Rom from the earliest days, Rom got into a lot of trouble when he showed up on Earth because he was perceived as killing people. Now, he knew that they were Direwraith aliens, and he also knew that he wasn't technically killing them. He was neutralizing them, which meant that he could, in theory, bring them back from limbo if he wanted to. So it was more like imprisoning them than killing them. But to the eyes of the ordinary people in whatever sleepy town it was that he landed in, I honestly cannot remember. They all just saw that he pulled out a gun and he shot people and they died. He disintegrated. And this created a conflict that led other heroes to fight Rom, because they thought that he was executing innocent people. They couldn't see the dire race, only he could. So I tried to do the same thing with Prontus. I tried to create a Rom sort of homage who, by the way that he operates, would inevitably fall into that group where the heroes show up and have an excuse to fight him. And, of course, the fight would eventually wind down, and they would realize that he was a good guy, but you'd get one good fight scene out of him before he tells you his tragic story. And then we move to the second phase, which is, oh, and I need help. Right? I have this huge, hopeless war I'm fighting. Prontus is one of the Star Blades, which is our kind of Space Knight homage. But this is where the fusion casting heads from Nexus come in. A Star Blade is really just an animated suit of armor. There's nobody actually in it. It's animated psychically by the Star Blade's actual body and mind, which are located far away across the galaxy in another location. And in order for this to work, the Star Blade, the actual being, the physical body, has to basically become completely paralyzed and put into a coma-like state. So Trontis' body is alive somewhere out in the galaxy, but he doesn't know where it is. So he's like a knight questing for the Holy Grail. He's trying to not only fight back against the Eidolons and all of their enemies, he's trying to find his own body, because at any moment that body could be killed and Trontis would die. Like any moment could be his last moment.
Did we go into the whole fall of Trontis' empire and the whole, you know, tragic fall of the Star Blades and, you know...
No, we haven't really talked about that. I wanted to... The Star Blades were destroyed by Crux Morta, who is the leader of the Eidolons and who is also a former Promethean. He's the... kind of the great rival to the leader of the Promethean race.
But the Starblade Empire was called Devonia.
Yeah, Devonia, right, Devonia. And the idea was that they had a Starblade. Starblade was a single person, like a great female knight. I think I named her Elaine. And Elaine was this champion of the Devonian people until the Eidolons arrived and Crux Morta disintegrated her with the Annihilance, which is his ultimate weapon.
Tell us a little bit about what that does, because that was kind of a cool bit.
Well, the Annihilance, I had to... It all goes back to Kirby, because Kirby had the best names, I swear, ever. He didn't always hit it out of the park, but I remember places like with Darkseid on Apocalypse, Planet of Apocalypse, where you had this suburb called the Armageddon. And I swear, Armageddon is genius. I will never think of anything that good. So the Annihilance is like that. I'm trying to put my toe words. And the Annihilance, it doesn't just destroy you. It destroys all evidence that you ever existed. So if I stab you with it, this podcast would disappear. Because, you know, you were in the podcast. Or actually, maybe only your voice would disappear from the podcast. There would all pictures of you would vanish from. There would be no physical evidence that you would ever existed. We would remember you, but there's no trace. And so this is what happened to the original Starblade. And in that moment, when all the people of Devonia saw her destroyed on, like, live television across the planet, people volunteered to take her place. And that's where the Starblades come from. And all these people who volunteered to go through this terrible procedure that basically robbed them of their bodies so that they could defend their planet against Crux Morta and the Eidolons. And they were winning until the inevitable betrayal. Curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal. And then that's when the war was lost and most of the Starblades were killed, but a small handful survived and have basically gone Ronin. And one of those is Trontis. The players encounter him when they probably meet him when he lands on the Earth looking for something. and then he kills a few aliens, and the players stop.
Kudos on the Serenity reference.
Oh, thank you. I everyone was silent. I thought for sure I was talking to, you know, a lost audience, but you got it.
I was just drinking some emergency, trying to bolster my failing immune system. it's no fun getting old, kids. But yeah, no, that was a cool bit, because that's sometimes the new guys have been well used, and sometimes, well, they haven't been. But that the Alliance is one of those, you know, cool things that, you know, you have there that kind of, I thought, captured the best.
Well, it's all John Gibbons' fault. He drew the guy with the giant spear, so I knew it had to be important.
You know, it's funny how many great ideas come from getting art from somebody new. Like, oh shit, how am I going to use this? And then
absolutely. Yeah. I like, you know, some of you know that I did a book called The Field Guide to Superheroes, and I thought, well, if I ever do a sequel, if I ever do The Field Guide to Supervillains, I want to work with the artist to make up the characters visually before I start statting them out, because, you know, artists, you guys are just better at character design visually than I am. If I make up bad guys, half of them all end up wearing trench coats. I mean, I have this sort of, I have this bad habit of going to the trench coat brigade, and I need good artists to come in and create visually interesting and dynamic characters, and then I can create a hell of a story for that guy.
Thank you. Funny enough, just as an artist myself, probably the worst thing you can get is from somebody saying he's a bad guy, but he's wearing a suit, and
exactly.
That's so boring. Give me something that's 6 feet wide or something. That's cool, you know. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. And you're right. And a lot of it comes from, like, kind of where comics are at these days. You know, a lot of comic films are sort of, they were, before the Avengers and the Marvel stuff got really popular. If you remember back to the first X-Men movie days, there was this idea that you'd only really do superheroes if you made them like the Matrix. Right, like everyone kind of had to wear the long black trench coats, and we had that joke in Wolverine, like, "Well, what do you expect? Yellow spandex?" You know. But when X-Men First Class came out, they're all wearing yellow spandex. So the mode has changed a lot, but I still kind of get influenced sometimes by that kind of Matrix mentality where cool means not in a costume, and artists shake me out of that, and I'm glad for it.
Yeah, that's why when I commission art, I usually try to go for the shortest and loosest brief possible. Because, you know, lots of times if someone is more visual than me, he's going to have a cooler idea than I'm going to have. And I acknowledge that and just let him do their thing.
Yeah. You know, like when we were writing up Stark City, all I knew about Dr. Judas was that he had to have a helmet. Because it had to, he was our sort of our Magneto guy. I really wanted him to have a sort of creepy, obscuring helmet, and he had to have a cape. I said, other than that, you can draw whatever you want. And you end up in a trench coat.
I think that was Dan Houser, if I remember right.
You know, whatever. but yeah, so whatever you want to do. I think you're right. I think that if the artist and the writer can have a good idea and then let the guy who does design for a living do what he does best, then I'll make a story for it. I can do that.
Oh, hey, Rom landed in Clairton in West Virginia.
What is that? Oh, say that again? Where?
Clairton. Yeah.
Well, that is a trivia question, isn't it? Okay. Never would have guessed that.
Yeah, that's, actually, I had forgotten that completely, but I read that comic book, oh my god, when I was a very young man, a long time ago.
Yes.
Reagan was still president.
Yeah. And I loved Rom. Isn't it amazing how some of these comics are so much better than the toys they were spun off of?
Yeah, it's a shame that Mattel, or whoever owns Mattel's IP or whatever, has held on to that for so long, because...
We have reliable testimony that Rom is returning in some form.
Really?
What is that? They did a Marvel Now cover or something. It was a Marvel cover that had a bunch of faces on the wall and kind of a Days of Future Past homage.
Yeah, they changed that.
They did.
Oh, they did? They took Rom off?
Yeah.
They took Rom.
Good Icon, yeah.
Yeah, Icon was the space knight that made up for the Annihilators. Yeah.
Ah... wounded to the heart. Oh, well.
I was hopeful there for a second, too, but yeah, it was not so big.
The last time we really saw that was there was a Space Knights, like a 4 or 6 issue limited series that Starlin wrote years ago.
Yeah.
Where Brandy appeared. She was like Queen of the Galadorians or something. And she talks about her husband, but she always calls him by his actual name, which, as I recall, yes. was Artur.
Yeah, I believe that is actually who Eichmann is. It's actually his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Brandy appears in the Annihilators miniseries.
I see. Okay.
They go to Galador and they save it from various stuff and things happening. And she shows
yeah, they can do all they just can't use Rom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they used Eichmann instead. I thought it was a fun series. Unfortunately, it seemed like the cosmic stuff at Marvel was kind of running out of steam at that point. I think that was the last work Abbott Lenny did for them before they went over and started writing Belcher Galactica for Dynamite or Boom. So yeah, that was the thing. And I think Galador's been destroyed, but that doesn't mean a whole lot in comic books. So.
Yeah, well, when you have a giant guy running around that eats planets, it's kind of inevitable.
Yeah. And Galactus is eating the ultimate Earth right now.
Yeah.
Are you guys following that?
Yes, I'm playing Cataclysm, yeah.
I haven't followed it. I only kind of know what I heard. What's Galactus' status?
Okay, they branched off of... there was a whole bunch of time travel going on in the Marvel 616.
Yeah.
And the premise is that, there's too much time travel. They have destroyed the space-time continuum. And
sure.
They're crossing over, and Galactus shows up in the Ultimate Comics universe and eats New Jersey on day one.
Yep.
And, you know, the Ultimates are trying to stop him, and Spider-Man's trying to stop him, and just nothing is working. And they're taking an awfully long time I was hoping it was going to be quicker than this. But
I thought it would be over by Cataclysm, and it still managed to carry on. It hasn't quite got there yet, but...
I thought it was going to be, like, you know, one issue, you know, maybe 100-page, you know, exercise. Galactus kills everybody, and the new Spider-Man guy manages to make it into the 616.
They're milking it for all it's worth.
But yeah, they've leaked a new one, haven't they? Apparently there might be something called Survival afterwards as well.
Yeah, they're going to have an event called Survival.
Characters go to 616 or even just to continue an Ultimate Universe, which is a bit odd. But yeah, I just want to see Galactus destroy something really big like that. That'd be really cool. So.
I think they want to get Miles Morales into the 616.
Yeah.
I suspect it's going to tie into the whole Superior Spider-Man stuff, and he's probably going to be the one to bring back Peter Parker. That's just my hunch. I don't know if that's going to happen. Yeah, I was wanting to just see it happen a lot faster, but there's a whole lot of, there's Galactus in the background. We need to save all these people. And then, you know, various heroes are having, you know, angsty drama while Galactus lurks in the background. And so it's not going as fast as I would like it to, but it is going. So anyway, interested to see how that turns out. But that's one cool thing about, I'm going to say it differently than you said it, Entropos?
Entropos, yeah.
Yeah. You make a good point in the book that he's not eating a planet; he's just removing all meaning from it.
Yeah.
Your GM could pull the Entropos trigger, and you might not even realize it. You know, just through role playing, you might realize that entropy is taking hold of your planet and all meaning's gone, and you need to find a way to reverse it somehow.
And I wanted to create something the players could actually accomplish. I mean, you can, and I wanted to do something different than Galactus, because let's be honest, Galactus is Galactus. You can only do like a world-eating giant once, you know? So what am I going to do that can compete with that? And so I went highbrow on it. And Entropos is like you described. It's funny, you're describing Cataclysm, and like Galactus is sort of this looming figure that is in the background of panels. And you describe it as a bad thing. That's kind of how Entropos works. He just sort of shows up at the planet, and he just sort of looms over it for months at a time. And the players are sort of having their own adventures, like, well, who is this giant space guy? What's he doing here? And how do we get him to go away? And he's not as obvious of a physical threat, because Galactus isn't somebody that you can just attack. I mean, despite the fact that we've seen it happen in amazing sort of times. What you really do is you fight his herald, right? You fight Silver Surfer or Fire Lord or the Destroyer or whatever it is that he's gotten as his herald that particular day, Terax. And we already had a herald for him. We had this great herald that we came up with in the Stark City book, who's a historical character, the first and last crown princess of Hawaii, who back in the 1800s was taken by Interpos and has been his herald ever since.
Well, she kind of pulled the Norrin Red. I mean, she talked out of, you know, doing his thing to Earth, and her payment slash reward for that slash punishment was she has to be his herald to seek out new worlds.
Yeah, and I wanted to play up the idea of the kind of Hawaii as humanity. Like, Hawaii is Shangri-La, or what was Norrin Rad's home? Zenla. Yeah. So Hawaii is Zenla, basically. And she, the great tragedy of this character, whose name became Sovereign Star, the great tragedy of this character is that she thinks, back on Earth, that Hawaii is an independent country. And that's why she's doing all of this. You know?
Well, because she was in the U.S. when he showed up, because she was on a goodwill tour, right?
Yeah, which is historical. She was actually, like, the actual Princess Kualani. I can't pronounce her name very well. But she was trying to preserve her nation against being annexed by the United States. She failed, historically. And in the Stark City timeline, while she was on this tour of the United States, Interpos showed up, and she persuaded him to leave Earth alone by her force of argument that, you know, you shouldn't, you don't have any right to do this, and who are you to judge what we are going to become? And Interpos said, okay, well, let me show you how things work in the galaxy. And he picked her up and, as you said, sort of punished her by making her into his herald, and she has never been back to Earth since. And she has no idea what's going on Earth, but of course, because her life is so awful, because she's had to lead Interpos to civilizations to satiate his cosmic need for meaning, she naturally fantasizes about Earth back home, and she has convinced herself that it's perfect. Well, she's in for a surprise. Right? For the players.
It's tragic, maybe more tragic origin than Tranches. And I wonder if, you know, it's kind of cheesy, but maybe it gives Interpos some cachet having a human as his herald.
Yeah.
Given the history of humans in this setting.
Well, it's a classic setup for Sovereign Star to rebel or be cast out, and for Interpos to need a new herald, and for this to become an issue in the campaign. Like, okay, who's going to be Interpos' new herald? And, of course, all the villains want the job. And that means that a player character will be chosen. Right? Because the last thing a player character wants is to become a herald of Galactus. Well, too bad. And like that's like when the Human Torch got chosen, right?
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, while we're talking about Interpos, you know, this kind of reminds me of The Nothing, another never-ending story.
That's right. Yes. Yes, you're right.
Okay.
This idea that the universe is slowly and inevitably devolving into null state, into a state of zero energy, of its non-existence. You know, this is one of the real questions of physics. And I remember for years, we accepted this as absolutely true, that it was proven, but then as we've come to understand more about dark matter and dark energy, we found out that the universe is actually expanding at an ever-increasing rate, that things are actually falling apart faster and faster all the time, that we don't really understand as much about the universe and its cosmic principles as we thought we did. And I'm fascinated by all that cosmology
stuff. Did you see that story last week about how this movie was, you know, advanced theoretical physics, how the universe could all actually be a hologram?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. That there's actually a two-dimensional universe on which everything is playing out for real. And our universe is just a hologram, a reflection of that universe.
That's just bizarre.
Jeez. That's one of those conversations you had back in the day in college when maybe the room's kind of smoky.
Well, you realize that would mean that the real universe is a comic book.
That's true, yeah. Two-dimensional, yeah. That's very true, yeah.
Have you guys been reading The Young Avengers?
No.
It's worth a look, if only for some of the page layouts. They're just absolutely beautiful. But,
yeah, I've seen some of that.
They've got Wiccan, you know, he's They've kind of built them up as you have this destiny to the Demiurge, just going to determine the direction of magic. And there's a scene where he sort of comes into his own in this battle with the enemy, and he literally steps out of the comic book.
Yeah.
And looks, everything beneath him is, the floor, the ground beneath him is, pages of the previous comic books.
Does he see us? Does he see the reader?
They don't have him look at the fourth wall or anything, no. But,
well, if he stepped out of the comic book, he's broken the fourth wall.
Well, but
he hasn't perceived, it's the moment to compare this to. Do you guys remember Seven Soldiers of Victory?
Yeah, the Grant Morrison one?
Yeah. Where Zatanna is pulled, she breaks out, physically breaks out of the page at the end of at the end of that book. And all the seven, they're like these seven men, which are basically the editors of DC Comics, standing around. And she breaks out, and they talk to each other, like, wow, you ever seen anybody do that before? Like, no, I haven't. But she doesn't get it. She's outside of the comic, and she breaks through the page, but she still can't realize that she's a character in a comic book. And that's where you're describing Wiccan as being. And it's one step removed from the kind of Buddy Baker Animal Man moment where he looks towards
that's
the
exactly
reader and says,
what I was gonna say.
Yeah. Says, I can see you.
That's a very Grant Morrison kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very he's very much into that kind of meta-text. And there's something interesting. Somehow everyone that does this does it with magic. You know, Animal Man was doing it on a kind of hallucinogenic dreamwalk and Australian dreamwalk. Zatanna does it with magic, and now Wiccan does it with magic.
It'd be kind of funny if Richards did it, just flip the panel every once in a while and said, hey, stop that, behave yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You never see anybody do this with science. It has to be something that's done with magic.
You know, there was a short-lived series called The Mighty Avengers, and I really loved it, but I think I'm the only one because it was canceled quickly. There was a scene where Hank Pym gets his butt kicked by the Marvel personification of the Cosmos, Eternity. And he's like, this is you doing it to yourself. This is... And then he stops and says, you are the scientist supreme of the universe. You know, act like it. And it's cheesy as hell, but I loved it. I thought they were going to do some more with that, but the book didn't sell well, so they folded it into Avengers Academy, where I imagine.
If we ever do a magic book for Stark City, I think I'm going to have to go all meta on it.
That could be cool.
Where the characters can somehow like step out of the role-playing game. Because we're not doing a comic, we're doing a role-playing game. So... we may have to play with that somehow.
Well, role-playing games are a lot more affordable to produce. A lot less frustrating.
Yeah.
Heartache as they are. Talk to some guys who are working on doing small press comics. Good lord. With friends of the podcast, Walt Lebilliard and Andrew Collis are doing Heroic. They did Kickstarter. And they're just talking to them, all the troubles with artists and everything else. And, it's been... they're fighting for months to get, the one issue done.
Yeah.
And after that, there's issue two. And everyone I ever known who's been in small press comics, unless they're that rare guy who's a writer slash artist who can do his own art.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, because you have to talk to some poor artist and they're doing 22 pages or 40 pages.
I talk to my students. I teach writing at my college. And the students ask me, well, why don't you write comic books? And I say, because I can't draw. I have to rely on someone else to draw the pages. I say, but you don't need to do that if you're a novelist. You can write a 500-page novel and edit it yourself and publish it yourself on Amazon Kindle or something, and you don't need anybody else. If you fail, it's all your fault. If you succeed, it's all yours. There's no point of failure.
Well, Jason, can we talk about that novel you're writing, or is that still NDA?
Oh gosh, I haven't signed a contract yet.
Then let's not say. I don't want to jinx it.
I hope that would be fun to talk about, but I shouldn't yet.
Okay, let's not say anything then.
I'm writing a novel. I can say that.
We're not making anyone mad if we say that. There's also, and this is cheesy, but if you're a fan of Fango Comics, or sorry, Fango Games, then we embrace the cheese. We love the cheese. We are the
cheese. Oh, cheese.
the goat cheese. We've got a Transformers homage in here.
Oh, that's right, we do. Yeah. So one of the things that we got in this book is a number of like little paragraphs, like one paragraph each about a number of organizations or alien empires or groups. And anyone who knows me knows that when I start to write on these books, I write long. You know, I think Mike asked for 10,000 and I gave him 20. And so I knew as I was closing on the end of this book that I was simply not going to have room to expand some of these paragraphs into the 5,000 word entries that I felt they required. And so I basically didn't even try. I just kind of left them as very small sort of sidebar entries. And one of those is the Mech Centrality. And the Mech Centrality was, I thought it was a Steve Perrin idea. But
it was.
Yeah. And the Mech Centrality was a kind of all, I mean, they're sort of like the Borg. You know, they were like an all robot, all artificially intelligent society. And I, for the longest time, I didn't know what to do with them. I was like, well, what am I going to, how am I going to make them interesting? What am I going to do? We have an adventure for Stark City that involves the Mech Centrality invading, attacking the Earth. And
that,
we have,
that would be come to the temple.
Yeah. Big stats for tons of spaceships and robots and, you know, very much the sort of traditional sci-fi kind of War of the Worlds, tons of bad guys and their hardware show up. But that's, and that's great, but it's kind of contrary to what I see superhero space games being about. We didn't have any personalities. We didn't have any, you know, dudes that you could punch. And so I thought, well, what could we do with it? And so all I could think of, the only idea I really had, was to work in a Transformers riff, where the Mech Centrality was torn by a kind of civil war, which the good guys had lost. And the good guys had lost, and they had been passed out, or they had fled. And they were sort of infiltration robots, which were designed to spy, to copy one piece of local technology, whatever it was, and they would be able to adapt their shape to fit that thing. Which, of course, means cars. Right? Because what else would it be? They could imitate any one piece of hardware. We didn't get a chance to write up any of these guys.
We did one. Joe Bardalis did stats for one.
Outstanding.
Peter did the art, and I believe
it's a drawing. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it's a Toyota Celica.
It is a Toyota.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So we'll want to have at least one in there. So
because if you can't have a scene in which Optimus Prime punches Thanos, I mean, you know, you're doing something wrong, right?
And for those old guys, you probably remember that for a brief shining moment, the Transformers were part of the Marvel Universe.
That's right!
Issue 7, is it? No, I don't know. Issue 7 in the British Transformers comic.
And there was very nearly, a JLA Transformers crossover.
That's right!
A couple years ago. And it got mixed at the last minute. So, once again, there's parts of the cosmic, superhero universe out there that don't always get serviced, and that was one of those I just wanted to do a hat tip for. And let's see, looking through the book, what haven't we mentioned?
I think we've gone over just about everything. I mean, I hope that, you know, you guys that are listening to this, I hope that you get some actual play time out of this book. A game book is of no use if it's not played. I mean, it's fun to read, and we all have sat around reading game books, but I hope that you're able to actually take it to the board, the tabletop, or take it to your Google Hangout, or however you choose to game these days, and actually, you know, throw down with Devourus or some of these other bad guys that we've created for you, and get into some of the politics of the Syrian Empire, or try to stop Crux Morta and his quest for the existential right, this sorcerous spell that will destroy anything you can name. Just take it out. I hope that you're able to take it out and sort of take it for a spin. That'll be fun.
Yeah, it's I love reading game books, but you know, it's it's fun to play games. People should play more games. And I
yeah.
That's one thing we do here is we try. I mean, we do a lot of actual play podcasts because the idea is you play what you write, and you know, it's these books are written to be played. Although it's, you know, I love Jason's writing, and this is a beautiful book to read. Hey, hey, you know, you've been a little quiet in this podcast. Was there any particular arc you like doing for this, or you know, anything that struck you in particular when you're going through this?
Well, I only did three pieces. I did the Bloodstone Protector of Shappy, the Speckag Octopus Alien.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did that? Oh, yeah. I love that guy. That guy's awesome.
He's quite cool, yeah. And the Mixed Centrality chap. Yeah, I just love the Space Ghosts, the Ghost World people. I just think they're great. So Space Ghosts are awesome, so anything like that is always really cool. So, yeah, I just think the entire thing it sits well together because it's a whole thing. You basically just gave everybody a universe to play in, but there's enough there to kind of put your own planets, and it doesn't have to be this is the final way of doing things. And yeah, it's really good.
Who did the galaxy map?
Was that Stefan?
That was Steph Worthington. He's a British
photographer. Awesome.
Yeah, the map is amazing. We had so much great talent. Can we call out the editor too?
Oh, yeah, please do.
So Kristen Perkins, who did our editing on this book and caught all kinds of embarrassing mistakes, thank you, and helped to make our book really, really great.
Yeah, I've known Kristen since the second grade, I believe.
There you go.
So, yeah, she we try to learn with each release at Fango Games, and we had some early releases that had a lot of typos, so now we hire a proofreader, and that was Kristen, she's our proofreader and editor-in-chief, and she did a really great job on this. So, thanks, Kristen, if you ever listen to this. But yeah.
Yeah, so we had such a great, great group of people.
Yeah. But yeah, Steph, we've been talking about this map for a few years. Once again, I've wanted to do a comic book for a long time.
Wow.
So yeah, we lay out, you know, the Milky Way galaxy, and here's the various spheres of influences, and here's the basic planets we discuss. And, you know, going back to the design philosophy for Stark City, you know, in the city itself, we highlighted some of the major neighborhoods,
yeah.
But then we left a lot of them undefined.
Yeah.
For the game masters, because if you're going to be playing in it, you know, and you should, you know, have some space to put your own mark on it.
Yeah.
So we've got three or four planets on the map, you know, that are illustrated and you've got their locations, and we just kind of leave it up to the game masters to decide, you know, what's going to go on here.
As long as the GM has plenty of books already in the book, I think this works out really well. You know, like, if you're playing Stark, well, I need an upscale neighborhood, I need a crime district, I need an industrial place. You have all those. So all the things that you need are there. And then we give you additional blank places that you can fill in with whatever you need that we could not predict.
That's right. Obviously, with the iconic setting rules that we had, with the aspects and stuff like that, and also the write-ups about using that planet in the game with some adventure hooks.
Yeah.
That helps as well. Rob's just going, here you go, here's a galactic empire.
Yeah.
we've got an idea how to use it, but it looks really pretty. We've actually given some ideas of how to run adventures there as well. So.
Yeah, totally. So, boy, a couple of things. You know, like I said, I was thinking we should do maybe a you know, two or three or four, you know, call it Space Icons and have it be, you know, other bit players, villains that we could, you know, do them as cheap PDFs and then point back to this book just as a way of trying to get the word out. What races would you want to flesh out if we were going to do that? I mean, you don't have to write them, Jason. I can write them myself because I know you're busy writing that novel we can't talk about. But
gosh, I don't know.
Maybe some of the races from the Crobon Empire.
You know.
Yeah, so then we've got the coolest names ever. You've got to see what they look like. Yeah.
That would be fun. I don't know. Now I'm thinking I might try and put some Micronauts in there.
Well, if you want to write them up.
If I could find it, I might take, like, it had to be like a really tiny planet, right, where everything is small. I have to think up a reason why they're tiny. Because I can't use the Microverse. I don't know. I have to think up. Maybe Entropo shrunk them. I don't know.
I remove all meaning from your life by making you 1 inch tall.
But yeah, I don't. There's plenty of things in here that we could expand. And I think what I would like to do, if I got a chance to add to this, I would like to do other things from space comics that we didn't get a chance to work in. Like, you know, I remember reading Nova when he first came out. With, like, the original Rick Ryder Nova. And I have a great fondness for that character, even though his comic was weird. And of course, now the Nova Corps is huge in the Marvel Universe, but, or what else? You know, it would be neat to put in some kind of, like, a pirate crew, like a space pirates. We have a space pirate group that we name. We talk about their sort of space station, I think.
Oh, but yeah.
We didn't get into their, like, the actual personalities on, like, any of their pirate ships, which would be a good sort of one-night adventure, I think, for player characters, right? Like, they're adventuring on some larger quest, and they find a space yacht that's getting attacked by pirates. And that would be a great, fun, kind of two-hour action-adventure scene where they fight off the space pirates and have a neat plot twist in there somewhere near the end.
Someone like Captain Harlock.
Yeah, well, of course, I think
we could definitely do that. We've got an adventure coming out. The last adventure for the Stark City Kickstarter has a secret research facility for one of the companies in Stark City on the moon. Gets attacked by some space pirates, and the pieces happen.
And one of the things that we see in a lot of space games, a lot of comics, is a kind of a bizarre group of aliens that are often used as mercenaries, like. Just kind of a hodgepodge collection of bizarre aliens from around the galaxy. It would be neat to create a kind of villain team like that that you could use in almost any scenario, really. They could be hired by almost anybody to do almost anything. The only thing that ties them together is that they're all aliens and they've all worked together. And this would allow us to maybe pull, like, maybe one or two of the Kroban Empire aliens out, and maybe someone, maybe there could be a Speakag in there or an Edelon. And you know, kind of play around, maybe one of the Promethean rooks or something, and kind of put a group together that a GM could use as a supervillain team.
Hmm, that is a cool idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to write that?
you know, if the fans demand, I got to write what the fans demand.
Well, so far we got some positive feedback from the Kickstarter backers. They received it. This book should be going out in RPG Now. I was thinking Tuesday or Wednesday. Give the backers a chance to download it first, and I'll probably put the podcast up same day it goes out, maybe link to it in the RPG Now description. So yeah, that could be something to check out. Let's see, yeah, if you folks like the book and you have any ideas for stuff you want to see, you know, please drop us a line here on the podcast website page, or you know, we're on Fainting Goat Games on Facebook. There's various ways to get in touch with any of us, so I could, you know, I always like to hear what people think and, you know, any
right.
suggestions.
Don't make us guess what you want.
Because we will guess wrong. And, you know, we'll wind up doing a tribute to some guy from the 70s. Remember that space trucker Marvel had in the 70s?
Are you talking about US-1?
Yes, yes.
I remember US-1 very well.
Yeah, so...
It showed up in She-Hulk.
Really?
Yeah. There was a thing, when Byrne was writing She-Hulk, the joke in that book was that all of Marvel's most ridiculous and stupid characters would show up. So we had US-1 for a while. Stilt Man was a big villain.
I love Stilt Man. Sorry. Yeah. That's great.
You would, eh? You would.
It's just, I think it's one of the very first, for some reason, it's one of the very first Marvel villains I ever saw.
Oh, really?
Really, really odd. I don't quite know why. There was a thing about... I think it was a what if Daredevil could see, and it was about... He saw Still, I'm not fighting him, or something. I don't know, anyway. But yeah, that was the Stiltman just struck me as like, okay, that's really stupidly cool.
You know, the funny thing, though, is that the reason why people remember Stiltman is because visually, he's very interesting.
Mm.
Right? I mean, he towers really high, so you can draw these great shots of him, like, walking across the city on his giant stilts, or... You know, the perspective shot with him tiny in the background and the great big legs in the foreground, you know? I mean, visually, he's interesting. He's a stupid villain, but he looks cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're in the supermarket, though, and you want to reach some high shelves, he's...
he was recently in Mark Waid's Daredevil.
Oh, I'm
again, stupid. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, this is what everyone's been in Mark Waid's Daredevil. If you're not checking that, you really should, because it's... goddamn, it's Mark Waid. If you're not reading, what's wrong with you? But,
yeah, I'm probably going to get the relaunch of the now version of when they do issue one again and then go buy the trades of the old series, because it does look really, really good. So.
Yeah, they were kind of weird about that. They were like, oh, we're canceling it, all good things must end, it's a shame. And then, oh, hey, we're relaunching with Mark
Actually,
Wade.
Actually, we're so, not, yeah. Shocker.
I think now, you know, these days, a number one issue just means we're starting a new story arc.
Almost, yeah. Yeah, well, Fantastic Four is definitely doing that. The current Fantastic Four series is wrapping up the story and then restarting as issue one again, so.
Yeah.
Is that any good these days? Red
costumes, that's bad. Well, Fantastic Four, at the moment, the current series, I'm not enjoying it very much.
Okay.
Each issue seems to be kind of self-contained. There is an arc that's supposed to be going through about them losing their powers and possibly regaining them, but most of the time it seems to be kind of ignored. I much preferred the Hickman run, which was beforehand.
The Council of Richards.
Yeah, that was excellent. Yeah, oh yeah, Council of Richards was brilliant. Yeah, yeah, all that kind of governance. But so next series, I think the next series is the Fall of Fantastic Four again, and they've got red costumes, which is just really odd.
Oh yeah, the new costumes. Yeah,
that's just not right. Blue or black? It's kind of red. That's crazy.
Do you remember when they got the black costumes for the first time in the Burn issues, and they all went in the Negative Zone?
Yeah, although the white Future Foundation ones are really cool as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I just got used to those. But
yeah, they're really cool.
You know, I saw something online that suggested, why doesn't Disney do a Fantastic Four Incredibles crossover? And I was thinking that would actually be pretty cool.
It's a little bit too on the nose, I think. That's why.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, they would meet each other and they'd be like, hey, you're like us.
Yeah,
a little bit too much
Incredibles
like us.
The best Fantastic Four movie ever made, yeah.
So they can't do it because they don't own the rights to Fantastic Four.
Oh, Sony does, yeah.
Fantastic
right.
Four licensed to Sony, yeah.
Yeah.
So instead you're going to get an X-Men Fantastic Four crossover.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, yeah, after Avengers made $4 billion or whatever, all of a sudden everyone's like, hey, more comic book movies.
Yeah. They hired somebody to do that. They hired, like, a Marvel writer to plan out their Fantastic Four X-Men crossovers.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but it's completely skipping me right now.
Well, I should head out, guys.
I should get back to work. Anything else you want to talk about in regards to the great game before we call it a podcast?
I just want to thank everybody who got to work on this. Abe, thank you so much for your amazing layout work.
No problem.
Nobody reads the book if it looks like crap, so thank you.
Well, yeah, I do my best. As long as it doesn't look like a photocopy or something, I'm quite happy.
You did a wonderful job. This book looks amazing.
Yeah, we got some good art from Scott Harshberger. We mentioned Steph Worthington. Dan contributes some good pieces.
Yep.
Walter Billiard of Hasbro Studios did a lot of our spaceships.
Yeah.
So that was cool. All right, then. Well, hey, I think we've talked ourselves to death. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Check out The Great Game on RPG Now, and we'll catch you next time on the Math Podcast.